CD 4.
Chocolat by Joanne Harris. Josephine Muska went by but did not stop. I was a little disappointed that she did not come in, for I'd been hoping to talk to her again. But she simply shot me a wild-eyed look as she passed, hands jammed deeply into her pockets. I noticed her face looked puffy, the eyes slitted closed, though it might have been against the gritty rain. The mouth zipped shut. A thick no-colour scarf bound her head like a bandage. I called to her, but she did not answer, quickening her step, as if at some impending danger. I shrugged and let her go. These things take time. Sometimes forever. Still later, when Anouk was playing in Les Marauds and I had closed shop for the day, I found myself strolling down the Avenue des Francs-Bourgeois in the direction of the Café de la République. It is a small, dingy place, soaped windows with an unchanging spécialité du jour scrawled across, and a scruffy awning which reduces the available light still further. Inside, a couple of silent slot machines flank the round tables at which the few customers sit, moodily discussing matters of no importance over interminable demis and café crème. There is the bland, oily smell of microwaved food, and a pall of greasy cigarette smoke hangs over the room, even though no one seems to be smoking. I noticed one of Caroline Clermont's hand-lettered yellow cards in a prominent position by the open door. A black crucifix hangs above it. I looked in, hesitated, and entered. Muska was at the bar. He eyed me as I walked in, his mouth stretching. Almost imperceptibly I saw his eyes flick to my legs, my breasts, whap-whap, lighting up like the dials on a slot machine. He laid a hand on the pump, flexing one heavy forearm. "What can I give you?" "Café cognac, please." The coffee came in a small brown cup with two wrapped sugar lumps. I took it to a table by the window. A couple of old men, one with a Légion d'honneur clipped to one frayed lapel, eyed me with suspicion. "Do you want some company?" smirked Muska from behind the bar. "It's just that you look a little lonely, sitting there on your own." "No, thank you," I told him politely. "In fact, I thought I might see Josephine today. Is she here?" Muska looked at me sourly, his good humour gone. "Oh, yes, your bosom friend." His voice was dry. "Well, you missed her. She just went upstairs to lie down, one of her sick headaches." He began to polish a glass with peculiar ferocity. "Spends all afternoon shopping, then has to lie down in the bloody evening while I do the work." "Is she all right?" He looked at me. "Course she is." His voice was sharp. "Why shouldn't she be? If her bloody ladyship could just get off her fat arse once in a while, we might even be able to keep this business afloat." He dug his dishcloth-wrapped fist into the glass, grunting with the effort. "I mean," he made an expressive gesture, "I mean, just look at this place." He glanced at me as if about to say something else. Then his gaze slid past me to the door. "Hey!" I gathered he was addressing someone just out of my field of vision. "Don't you people listen? I'm closed." I heard a man's voice say something indistinct in reply. Muska gave his wide, cheerless grin. "Can't you idiots read?" Behind the bar, he indicated the yellow twin of the card I had seen at the door. "Get lost. Go on." I stood up to see what was happening. There were five people standing uncertainly at the café entrance, two men and three women. All five were strangers to me, unremarkable but for their air of indefinable otherness. The patched trousers, the work boots, the faded T-shirts which proclaimed them outsiders. I should know that look. I had it once. The man who had spoken had red hair and a green bandana to keep it out of his face. His eyes were cautious, his tone carefully neutral. "We're not selling anything," he explained. "We just want to get a couple of beers and some coffee. We're not going to be any trouble."
Muska looked at him in contempt.
"I said we're closed." One of the women, a drab, thin girl with a pierced eyebrow, tugged at the redhead's sleeve. "It's no good, Rue. We'd better..."
"Wait a minute."
Rue shook her off impatiently.
"I don't understand. The lady who was here a moment ago, your wife, she was going to..."
"Screw my wife!" exclaimed Muska shrilly. "My wife couldn't find her arse with both hands and a pocket torch. It's my name above the door, and I say we're closed."
He had taken 3 steps from behind the bar, and now he stood barring the doorway, hands on hips, like an overweight gunslinger in a spaghetti western. I could see the yellowy gleam of his knuckles at his belt, hear the whistle of his breath. His face was congested with rage.
"Right."
Rue's face was expressionless. He flicked a hostile, deliberate glance at the few customers scattered about the room.
"Closed."
Another glance around the room. For a moment our eyes met.
"Closed to us," he said quietly.
"Well, not as stupid as you look, are you?" said Muska with sour glee. "We had enough of your lot last time. This time we're not standing for it."
"Okay."
Rue turned to go. Muska saw him off, strutting stiff-legged like a dog scenting a fight. I walked past him without a word, leaving my coffee half-finished on the table. I hope he wasn't expecting a tip. I caught up with the river gypsies halfway down the Avenue des Francs-Bourgeois. It had begun to drizzle again, and the 5 of them looked drab and sullen. I could see their boats now, down in Les Marais, 12 of them, 24. A flotilla of green, yellow, blue, white, red, some flying flags of damp washing, others painted with Arabian nights and magic carpets and unicorn variations reflected in the dull green water. "I'm sorry that happened," I told them. "They're not an especially welcoming lot in Lansquenet-sur-Tarn." Rue gave me a flat, measuring look. "My name is Vianne," I told him. "I have the chocolaterie, just opposite the church. La Céleste Praline." He watched me, waiting. I recognized myself in his carefully expressionless face. I wanted to tell him, to tell all of them, that I knew their rage and humiliation, that I'd known it too, that they weren't alone. But I also knew their pride, the useless defiance which remains after everything else has been scoured away. The last thing they wanted, I knew, was sympathy. "Why don't you drop in tomorrow?" I asked lightly. "I don't do beer, but I think you might enjoy my coffee." He looked at me sharply, as if he suspected me of mocking him. "Please come," I insisted. "Have coffee and a slice of cake on the house. All of you." The thin girl looked at her friends and shrugged. Rue returned the gesture.
"Maybe."
The voice was non-committal.
"We got a busy schedule,"
chirped the girl pertly. I smiled. "Find a window," I suggested. Again that measuring, suspicious look.
"Maybe."
I watched them go down into Les Marais as Anouk came running up the hill towards me, the tails of her red raincoat flapping like the wings of an exotic bird.
"Maman! Maman, look! The boats!"
We admired them for a while, the flat barges, the tall houseboats with the corrugated roofs, the stovepipe chimneys, the frescoes, the multicoloured flags, slogans, painted devices to ward against accident and shipwreck, the small barks, fishing lines, pots for crayfish hoisted up against the tide mark for the night, tattered umbrellas sheltering decks, the beginnings of campfires in steel drums on the riverside. There was a smell of burning wood and petrol and frying fish, a distant sound of music from across the water as a saxophone began its eerily human melodious wail. Halfway across the tan, I could just make out the figure of a red-headed man standing alone
on the deck of a plain black houseboat. As I watched, he lifted his arm. I waved back. It was almost dark when we made our way home. Back in Les Moreaux, a drummer had joined the saxophone and the sounds of his drumming slapped flatly off the water. I passed the Café de la République without looking in. I had barely reached the top of the hill when I felt a presence at my elbow. I turned and saw Josephine Muscat, coatless now but with a scarf around her head and half covering her face. In the semi-darkness she looked pallid, nocturnal. "Run home, Anouk. Wait for me there." Anouk gave me a curious glance, then turned and ran off obediently up the hill, her coattails flapping wildly. "I heard what you did." Josephine's voice was hoarse and soft. "You walked out because of that business with the river people." I nodded. "Of course." "Paul Marie was furious." The stern note in her voice was almost admiration. "You should have heard the things he was saying." I laughed. "Fortunately, I don't have to listen to anything Paul Marie has to say," I told her blandly. "Now I'm not supposed to talk to you any more," she went on. "He thinks you're a bad influence." A pause, as she looked at me with nervous curiosity. "He doesn't want me to have friends," she added. "Seems to me I'm hearing rather too much about what Paul Marie wants," I said mildly. "I'm not really all that interested in him. Now you," I touched her arm fleetingly, "I find you quite interesting." She flushed and looked away as if expecting to find someone standing at her shoulder. "You don't understand," she muttered. "I think I do." With my fingertips I touched the scarf which hid her face. "Why do you wear this?" I asked abruptly. "Do you want to tell me?" She looked at me in hope and panic, shook her head. I pulled gently at the scarf. "You're pretty," I said as it came loose. "You could be beautiful." There was a fresh bruise just beneath her lower lip, bluish in the failing light. She opened her mouth for the automatic lie. I interrupted her. "That's not true," I said. "How can you know that?" Her voice was sharp. "I haven't even said..." "You didn't have to." Silence. Across the water, a flute scattered bright notes among the drumbeats. When Josephine spoke at last, her voice was thick with self-loathing. "It's stupid, isn't it?" Her eyes were tiny crescents. "I never blame him. Not really. Sometimes I even forget what really happened." She took a deep breath like a diver going under. "Walking into doors, falling downstairs, stepping on rakes." She sounded close to laughter. I could hear hysteria bubbling beneath the surface of her words. "Accident prone. That's what he says I am. Accident prone." "Why was it this time?" I asked gently. "Was it because of the river people?" She nodded. "They didn't mean any harm. I was going to serve them." Her voice rose shrilly for a second. "I don't see why I should have to do what that bitch Clermont wants all the time. Oh, we must stand together," she mimicked savagely. "For the sake of the community. For our children, Madame Muscat." Breaking back into her own voice with a stricken intake of breath. "When in normal circumstances she wouldn't say hello to me in the street, wouldn't give me steam off her shit." She took another deep breath, controlling the outburst with an effort. "It's always caro this, caro that. I've seen the way he looks at her in church." "Why can't you be like caro Clermont?" Now she was her husband, his voice thick with beery rage. She even managed his mannerisms, the thrust-out chin, the strutting aggressive posture. "She makes you look like a clumsy sow. She's got style, class. She's got a fine son doing well at school. And what have you got, eh?" "Josephine." She turned towards me with a stricken expression. "I'm sorry. For a moment I almost forgot where..." "I know," I could feel rage pricking at my thumbs. You must think I'm stupid to have stayed with him all these years. Her voice was dull, her eyes dark and resentful. No, I don't. She ignored my reply. Well, I am, she declared, stupid and weak. I don't love him, can't remember a time when I ever loved him. But when I think of actually leaving him... She broke off in confusion. Actually leaving him, she repeated in a low, wondering voice. No, it's no use. She looked up at me again, and her face was closed, final. That's why I can't talk to you again, she told me in calm desperation. I couldn't leave you guessing. You deserve better than that. But this is how it has to be. No, I told her, it doesn't. But it does. She defends herself bitterly, desperately, against the possibility of comfort. Can't you see? I'm no good. I steal. I lied to you before. I steal things. I do it all the time. Gently, yes, I know. The clear realization turns quietly between us like a Christmas bauble. Things can be better, I told her at last. Paul Marie doesn't rule the world. He might as well, retorted Josephine mulishly. I smiled. If that stubbornness of hers could be turned out instead of in, what could she not achieve? I could do it, too. I could feel her thoughts so close, welcoming me in. It would be so easy to take control. I turned the thought aside impatiently. I had no right to force her to any decision. Before, you had no one to go to, I said. Now you do. Do I? In her mouth, it was almost an admission of defeat. I did not reply. Let her answer that for herself. She looked at me in silence for a while. Her eyes were full of river lights from Les Marais. Again it struck me with what smaller twist she might become beautiful. Good night, Josephine. I did not turn to look at her, but I know she watched me as I made my way up the hill, and I know she stood watching long after I had rounded the corner and disappeared from sight. Tuesday, February the 25th. Still more of this interminable rain. It falls like a piece of the sky upended to pour misery onto the aquarium life below. The children, bright plastic ducks in their waterproofs and boots, squawk and waddle across the square, their cries ricocheting off the low clouds. I work in the kitchen with half an eye to the children in the street. This morning I unmade the window display, the witch, the gingerbread house, and all the chocolate animals sitting around watching with glossy, expectant faces, and Anouk and her friends shared the pieces between excursions into the rainy backwaters of Les Marais. Jeannot Drou watched me in the kitchen, a piece of gilded pain d'épices in each hand, eyes shining. Anouk stood behind him, the others behind her, a wall of eyes and whisperings. What next? He has the voice of an older boy, an air of casual bravado, and a smear of chocolate across the chin. What are you doing next? For the display? I shrugged. Secret, I said, stirring crème de cacao into an enamel basin of melted couverture. No, really, he insists. You ought to make something for Easter. You know, eggs and stuff. Chocolate hens, rabbits, things like that. Like the shops in Agen. I remember them from my childhood. The Paris chocolaterie, with their baskets of foil-wrapped eggs, shelves of rabbits and hens, bells, marzipan fruits and marron glacé, amourettes and filigree nests filled with petit fours and caramels, and 1001 epiphanies of spun sugar magic carpet rides, more suited to an Arabian harem than the solemnities of the Passion. I remember my mother telling me about the Easter chocolates. There was never enough money to buy those exquisite things, but I always had my own cornet surprise, a paper cone containing my Easter gifts, coins, paper flowers, hard-boiled eggs painted in bright enamel colours, a box of coloured papier-mâché, painted with chickens, bunnies, smiling children among the buttercups. The same every year, and stored carefully for the next time, encasing a tiny packet of chocolate raisins wrapped in cellophane, each one to be savoured long and lingeringly in the lost hours of those strange nights between cities, with the neon glow of hotel signs blinking between the shutters, and my mother's breathing, slow and somehow eternal, in the umbrous silence. She used to say that on the eve of Good Friday, the bells leave their steeples and church towers in the secret of the night and fly with magical wings to Rome. He nods, with that look of half-believing cynicism peculiar to the growing young. They line up in front of the Pope in his gold and white, his mitre and his gilded staff, big bells and tiny bells, clochettes and heavy bourdons, carillons and chimes and do-si-do-mi-sols, all waiting patiently to be blessed. She was filled with this solemn children's lore, my mother, eyes lighting up with delight at the absurdity. All stories delighted her, Jesus and Easter and Ali Baba working the homespun of folklore into the bright fabric of belief again and again. Crystal healing and astral travel, abductions by aliens and spontaneous combustions. My mother believed them all, or pretended to believe. And the Pope blesses them, every one, far into the night, the thousands of France's steeples waiting empty for their return, silent until Easter morning. And I, her daughter, listening wide-eyed to her charming apophrica, with tales of Mithras and Baldur the Beautiful and Osiris and Quetzalcoatl, all interwoven with stories of flying chocolates and flying carpets and the triple goddess and Aladdin's crystal cave of wonders and the cave from which Jesus rose after 3 days. Amen. Abracadabra. Amen. And the blessings turn into chocolates of all shapes and kinds, and the bells turn upside down to carry them home. All through the night they fly, and when they reach their towers and steeples on Easter Sunday, they turn over and begin swinging to peal out their joy. Bells of Paris, Rome, Cologne, Prague. Morning bells, ringing the changes across the years of our exile. Easter bells so loud in memory that it hurts to hear them. And the chocolates fly out across the fields and towns. They fall through the air as the bells sound. Some of them hit the ground and shatter. But the children make nests and place them high in the trees to catch the falling eggs and praline and chocolate hens and rabbits and guimauve and almonds. Jeannot turns to me with vivid face and broadening grin. Cool! And that's the story of why you get chocolates at Easter. His voice is awed, sharp with sudden certainty. Do it! Please do it! I turn deftly to roll a truffle in cocoa powder. Do what? Do that! The Easter story! It'd be so cool, with the bells and the Pope and everything. And you could have a chocolate festival a whole week, and we could have nests and Easter egg hunts and... He breaks off excitedly, tugging at my sleeve imperiously. Madame Rocher, please! Behind him, Anouk watches me closely. A dozen smudgy faces in the background, mouths shy entreaties. A grand festival du chocolat. I consider the thought. In a month's time, the lilacs will be out. I always make a nest for Anouk, with an egg and her name on it in silver icing. It could be our own carnival, a celebration of our acceptance in this place. The idea is not new to me, but to hear it from this child is almost to touch its reality. We'll need some posters. I pretend hesitation.
We'll make those.
Anouk is the first to suggest it, her face vivid with excitement.
And flags, bunting, streamers, and a chocolate Jesus on the cross with the Pope in white chocolate. Chocolate lambs, egg rolling competitions, treasure hunts. We'll invite everyone. It'll be cool. So cool.
I waved my arms at them for silence, laughing. An arabesque of acrid chocolate powder followed my gesture.
You make the posters, I told them. Leave the rest to me.
Anouk leapt at me, arms outflung. She smells of salt and rainwater, a cuprous scent of soil and waterlogged vegetation. Her tangled hair is barbed with droplets.
Come up to my room, she shrieked in my ear. They can, can't they, Maman? Say they can. We can start right now. I've got paper, crayons.
They can, I said.
An hour later, the display window was embellished by a large poster, Anouk's design executed by Jeannot. The text, in large, shaky green letters, read, Grand Festival du Chocolat. At La Céleste Praline, begins Easter Sunday. Everyone welcome. Buy now while stocks last. Around the text capered various creatures of fanciful design. A figure in a robe and a tall crown I took to be the Pope. Cut-out shapes of bells had been pasted thickly at his feet. All the bells were smiling. I spent most of the afternoon tempering the new batch of couverture and working on the window display. A thick covering of green tissue paper for the grass. Paper flowers, daffodils and daisies, Anouk's contribution, pinned to the window frame. Green-covered tins, which once contained cocoa powder, stacked up against each other to make a craggy mountainside. Crinkly cellophane paper wraps it like a covering of ice. Running past and winding into the valley, a river of blue silk ribbon, upon which a cluster of houseboats sit quiet and unreflecting. And below, a procession of chocolate figures, cats, dogs, rabbits, some with raisin eyes, pink marzipan ears, tails made of licorice whips with sugar flowers between their teeth. And mice. On every available surface, mice. Running up the sides of the hill, nestling in corners, even on the riverboats. Pink and white sugar coconut mice, chocolate mice of all colours, variegated mice marbled through with truffle and maraschino cream, delicately tinted mice, sugar-dappled frosted mice. And standing above them, the Pied Piper, resplendent in his red and yellow, a barley sugar flute in one hand, his hat in the other. I have hundreds of moulds in my kitchen, thin plastic ones for the eggs and the figures, ceramic ones for the cameos and liqueur chocolates. With them, I can recreate any facial expression and superimpose it upon a hollow shell, adding hair and detail with a narrow-gauge pipe, building up torso and limbs in separate pieces, and fixing them in place with wires and melted chocolate. A little camouflage, a red cloak rolled from marzipan. A tunic, a hat of the same material, a long feather brushing the ground at his booted feet. My Pied Piper looks a little like Roo, with his red hair and motley garb. I cannot help myself. The window is inviting enough, but I cannot resist the temptation to gild it a little, closing my eyes to light the whole with a golden glow of welcome. An imaginary sign which flashes like a beacon, come to me. I want to give, to make people happy. Surely that can do no harm. I realize that this welcome may be in response to Caroline's hostility to the travelers, but in the joy of the moment I can see no harm in that. I want them to come. Since we last spoke, I have glimpsed them occasionally, but they seem suspicious and furtive, like urban foxes ready to scavenge but not to be approached. Mostly I see Roux, their ambassador, carrying boxes or plastic bags of groceries. Sometimes Zazette, the thin girl with the pierced eyebrow. Last night two children tried to sell lavender outside the church, but Renaud moved them on. I tried to call them back, but they were too wary, watching me with slant-eyed hostility before pelting off down the hill into Les Marais. I was so absorbed in my plans and the layout of my window that I lost track of the time. Anouk made her friend sandwiches in the kitchen, then they disappeared again in the direction of the river. I put on the radio and sang to myself as I worked, carefully placing the chocolates into pyramids. The magic mountain opens to reveal a bewildering, half-glimpsed array of riches. Multicolored piles of sugar crystals, glacé fruits and sweets which glitter like gems. Behind this, and shielded from the light by the concealed shelving, lie the saleable wares. I will have to begin work on the Easter goods almost straight away, anticipating extra custom. It is a good thing there is storage space in the cool basement of the house. I must order gift boxes, ribbons, cellophane paper, and trimmings. I was so absorbed that I barely heard Armand as she came in through the half-open door. "Well, hello," she said in her brusque manner. "I came for another one of your chocolate specials, but I can see you're busy." I manoeuvred carefully out of the window. "No, of course not," I told her. "I was expecting you. Besides, I've nearly finished and my back is killing me." "Well, if it's no trouble." Her manner was different today. There was a kind of crispness in her voice, a studied casualness which masked a high level of tension. She was wearing a black straw hat trimmed with ribbon and a coat, also black, which looked new. "You are very chic today," I observed. She gave a sharp crack of laughter. "No one said that to me for a while, I'll tell you," she said, poking a finger at one of the stools. "Could I climb up there without breaking a leg, do you think?" "I'll get you a chair from the kitchen," I suggested, but the old lady stopped me with an imperious gesture. "Rubbish." She eyed the stool. "I used to be quite a climber in my youth." She drew up her long skirts, revealing stout boots and lumpy grey stockings. "Trees, mostly. I used to climb up them and throw twigs onto the heads of passers-by. Ha!" A grunt of satisfaction as she swung herself onto the stool, grabbing hold of the countertop for support. I caught a sudden, alarming swirl of scarlet from under her black skirt. Armand perched on the stool, looking absurdly pleased with herself. Carefully, she smoothed her skirts back over the shimmer of scarlet petticoat. "Red silk undies," she grinned, seeing my look. "You probably think I'm an old fool, but I like them. I've been in mourning for so many years. Seems every time I can decently wear colours, someone else drops dead, that I've pretty much given up wearing anything but black." She gave me a look fizzing with laughter. "But underwear, now that's a different thing." She lowered her voice conspiratorially. "Mail order from Paris," she said. "Costs me a fortune." She rocked with silent laughter on her perch. "Now, how about that chocolate?" I made it strong and black, and with her diabetic condition in mind, added as little sugar as I dared. Armand saw my hesitancy and stabbed an accusing finger at her cup. "No rationing," she ordered. "Give me the works. Chocolate chips. One of those sugar stirrer things. Everything. Don't you start getting like the others, treating me as if I didn't have the wit to look after myself. Do I look senile to you?" I admitted she didn't. "Well, then." She sipped the strong, sweetened mixture with visible satisfaction. "Good. Very good. Supposed to give you energy, isn't it? It's a, what do you call it, a stimulant." I nodded. "An aphrodisiac, too, so I heard," added Armand roguishly, peeping at me from above the rim of her cup. "Those old men down at the cafe had better watch out. You're never too old to have a good time." She cawed shrill laughter. She sounded shrill and keyed up, her crabbed hands unsteady. Several times she put her hand to the brim of her hat as if to adjust it. I looked at my watch under cover of the counter, but she saw my movement.
"Don't expect he'll turn up," she said shortly. "That grandson of mine. I'm not expecting him anyway."
Her every gesture belied her words. The tendons in her throat stood out like an ancient dancer's. We talked for a while of trifling matters, the children's idea of the chocolate festival, Armand squawking with laughter when I told her about Jesus and the white chocolate pope, and the river gypsies. It seems that Armand had ordered their food supplies herself, in her name, much to Renaud's indignation. Rue offered to pay her in cash, but she prefers to have him fix her leaky roof instead. This will infuriate Georges Clermont, she revealed, with an impish grin. He'd like to think he's the only one who can help me out, she said with satisfaction. Bad as each other, both of them, clucking about subsidence and damp. They want me out of that house, that's the truth of it. Out of my nice house and into some lousy old folks' home where you have to ask permission to go to the bathroom. She was indignant, her black eyes snapping. Well, I'll show them, she declared. Rue used to be a builder before he went on the river. He and his friends will make a good enough job of it. And I'd rather pay them to do the work honestly than to have that imbecile do it for free. She adjusted the brim of her hat with unsteady hands. Well, I'm not expecting him, you know. I knew it was not the same person to whom she referred. I looked at my watch. 4:20. Night was already falling, and yet I'd been so sure. That was what came of interfering, I told myself savagely, so easy to inflict pain on others, on myself. I never imagined he would come, continued Armand, in that crisp, determined voice. She's seen to that all right. Taught him well, she has. She began to struggle off her perch. I've been taking up too much of your time already, she said shortly. I must be... Mémé? She twists around so abruptly that I'm sure she must fall. The boy is standing quietly by the door. He's wearing jeans and a navy sweatshirt. He has a wet baseball cap on his head. In his hand he carries a small, scuffed, hardback book. His voice is soft and self-conscious. I had to wait until my mother went out. She's at the hairdresser's. She won't be back till six. Armand looks at him. They do not touch, but I feel something pass between them like a jolt of electricity. Too complex for me to analyze, but there is warmth and anger, embarrassment, guilt, and behind it all, a promise of softness. You look soaked. I'll make you a drink, I suggest, going into the kitchen. As I leave the room, I hear the boy's voice again, low and hesitant. Thanks for the book, he says. I've got it here with me. He holds it out like a white flag. It is no longer new, but worn like a book which has been read and reread lovingly and often. Armand registers this, and the fixed look disappears from her face. Read me your favorite poem, she says. From the kitchen, as I pour chocolate into two tall glasses, as I stir in cream and kalua, as I make enough noise with pots and bottles to give the illusion of privacy, I hear his voice raised, stilted at first, then gaining rhythm and confidence. I cannot make out the words, but from a distance it sounds like prayer or invective. I notice that when he reads, the boy does not stutter. I set the two glasses carefully onto the counter. As I entered, the boy stopped speaking mid-sentence and eyed me with polite suspicion, his hair falling into his eyes like the mane of a shy pony. He thanked me with scrupulous courtesy, sipped his drink with more mistrust than pleasure. I'm not supposed to have this, he said doubtfully.
My mother says chocolate makes me come out in zits.
And it could make me drop dead on the spot, said Armand smartly. She laughed at his expression.
Come on, boy. Don't you ever doubt what your mother says? Or has she brainwashed what little sense you might have inherited from me right out of you?
Luke looked nonplussed.
It's just what she says, he repeated lamely.
Armand shook her head.
Well, if I want to hear what Caro says, I can make an appointment, she said. What have you got to say? You're a smart lad, or used to be. What do you think?
Luke sipped again. I think she might have been exaggerating, he said with a tiny smile.
You look pretty good to me.
No zits either, said Armand.
He was surprised into laughter. I liked him better this way, his eyes flaring a brighter green, his impish smile oddly like his grandmother's. He remained guarded, but behind his deep reserve, I began to glimpse a ready intelligence and sharp sense of humour. He finished his chocolate but refused a slice of cake, though Armand took two. For the next half hour they talked, while I pretended to go about my business. Once or twice I caught him looking at me with a wary curiosity, the flickering contact between us broken as soon as it was made. I left them to it. It was 5:30 when they both said goodbye. There was no talk of another meeting, but the casual fashion with which they parted suggested that both had the same thought in mind. It surprised me a little to see them so alike, circling each other with the caution of friends reunited after long years of separation. They both have the same mannerisms, the same direct way of looking, the slanting cheekbones, sharp chin. When his features are in repose, this similarity is partially obscured, but animation makes him more like her, erasing from them that look of bland politeness which she deplores. Armand's eyes are shining beneath the brim of her hat. Luke seems almost relaxed, his stutter receding to a slight hesitancy, barely noticeable. I see him pause at the door, wondering perhaps whether he should kiss her. On this occasion, his adolescent's dislike of contact is still too strong. He lifts a hand in a shy gesture of farewell, then is gone. Armand turns towards me, flushed with triumph. For a second, her face is naked in its love, hope, pride. Then the reserve which she shares with her grandson returns, a look of enforced casualness, a gruff note in her voice as she says, I enjoyed that, Vianne. Perhaps I'll come again. Then she gives me one of her direct looks, reaching out a hand to touch my arm. You're the one who brought him here, she said. I wouldn't have known how to do it myself. I shrugged. It would have happened at some time or another, I said. Luke isn't a child any more. He has to learn to do things his own way. Armand shook her head. No, it's you, she told me stubbornly. She was close enough for me to smell her Lily of the Valley perfume. The wind's changed since you've been here. I can still feel it. Everyone feels it. Everything's on the move. Whee! She gave a little crow of amusement.
But I'm not doing anything, I protested, half laughing with her. I'm just minding my own business, running my shop, being me.
In spite of my own laughter, I felt uneasy.
It doesn't matter, replied Armand. It's still you that's doing it. Look at all the changes. Me, Luke, Caro, the folks out on the river.
She jerked her head sharply in the direction of Les Marauds.
Even him in his ivory tower across the square.
All of us changing. Speeding up. Like an old clock being wound up after years of telling the same time. It was too close to my own thoughts of the week before. I shook my head emphatically.
That isn't me, I protested. It's him, Renaud, not me.
A sudden image at the back of my mind, like the turn of a card. The black man in his clock tower,
turning the machinery faster and faster, ringing the changes, ringing the alarum, ringing us out of town. And with that unsettling image comes one of an old man on a bed, tubes in his nose and arms, and the black man standing over him in grief or triumph, while at his back, fire-burned. "Is it his father?" I said the first words which came into my head. "I mean the old man he visits in the hospital. Who is it?" Armand gave me a sharp look of surprise. "How do you know about that?" "Sometimes I have feelings about people." For some reason I was reluctant to admit to scrying with the chocolate, reluctant to use the terminology with which my mother had made me so familiar. "Feelings?" Armand looked curious, but did not question me further. "So there is an old man, then?" I could not shake off the thought that I had stumbled upon something important, some weapon, perhaps, in my secret struggle against Renaud. "Who is he?" I insisted. Armand gave a shrug. "Another priest," she said, with dismissive contempt, and would say no more. Wednesday, February the 26th. When I opened this morning, Roux was waiting at the door. He was wearing denim overalls, and his hair was tied back with string. He looked to have been waiting for some time, because his hair and shoulders were furred with droplets from the morning mist. He gave me something that was not quite a smile, then looked behind me into the shop where Anouk was playing. "Hello, little stranger," he said to her. This time his smile was real enough, lighting his wary face briefly. "Do come in." I beckoned him inside. "You should have knocked. I didn't see you out there." Roux muttered something in his thick Marseille accent and crossed the threshold rather self-consciously. He moves with an odd combination of grace and clumsiness, as if he feels uncomfortable indoors. I poured him a tall glass of black chocolate laced with Kahlua. "You should have brought your friends," I told him lightly. He gave a shrug in reply. I could see him looking around, taking in his surroundings with keen, if suspicious, interest. "Why don't you sit down?" I asked, pointing to the stools at the counter. Roux shook his head. "Thanks." He took a mouthful of the chocolate. "Actually, I wondered if you'd be able to help me. Us." He sounded embarrassed and angry at the same time. "It isn't money," he added quickly, as if to prevent me from speaking. "We'd pay for it all right. It's just the organization we're having difficulty with." He shot me a look of unfocused resentment. "Armand, Madame Voisin said you'd help," he said. He explained the situation as I listened quietly, nodding encouragement on occasion. I began to understand that what I had taken for inarticulacy was simply a deep dislike of having to ask for help. Through the thick accent, Roux spoke like an intelligent man. He had promised Armand that he would repair her roof, he explained. It was a relatively easy job, which would take only a couple of days. Unfortunately, the only local supplier of wood, paint, and the other materials needed to complete the task was Georges Clermont, who flatly refused to supply them to either Armand or Roux. If Mother wanted repairs to her roof, he told her reasonably, then she should ask him, not a bunch of swindling vagrants. It wasn't as if he hadn't been asking, begging her to let him do the work free of charge for years. Let the gypsies into her house and God only knew what might happen. Valuables looted, money stolen. It wasn't unknown for an old woman to be beaten or killed for the sake of her few poor possessions. No, it was an absurd scheme, and in all conscience he couldn't. "Sanctimonious bastard," said Roux viciously. "Knows nothing about us, nothing. The way he talks, we're all thieves and murderers. I've always paid my way. I've never begged from anyone. I've always worked." "Have some more chocolate," I suggested mildly, pouring another glassful. "Not everybody thinks like Georges and Caroline Clermont." "I know that." His posture was defensive, arms crossed over his body. "I've used Clermont to do repairs for me before," I continued. "I'll tell him I want to do some more work on the house. If you give me a list of what you need, I'll get it.
I'll pay for it all, said Roux again, as if this issue of payment were something he could not stress enough. The money really isn't a problem. Of course.
Roux relaxed a little and drank more chocolate. For the first time he seemed to register how good it was, and gave me a smile of sudden and peculiar sweetness.
She's been good to us, Armand, he said. She's been ordering food supplies for us, and medicines for Zazette's baby. She stood up for us when that poker-faced priest of yours turned up again.
He's no priest of mine, I interrupted quickly. In his mind, I'm as much of an interloper in Lansquenet as you are.
Roux looked at me in surprise.
No, really, I told him. I think he sees me as a corrupting influence. Chocolate orgies every night. Fleshly excesses when decent people should be in bed, alone. His eyes are the hazy, no colour of a city skyline in the rain. When he laughs, they gleam with malice. Anouk, who had been sitting in uncharacteristic silence while he spoke, responded to it and laughed too.
Don't you want any breakfast? Piped Anouk. We've got pain au chocolat. We've got croissant too, but the pain au chocolat is better.
He shook his head. I don't think so, he said, thanks. I put one of the pastries on a plate and set it beside him.
On the house, I told him. Try one, I make them myself.
Somehow it was the wrong thing to say. I saw his face close again, the flicker of humour replaced by the now familiar look of careful blankness.
I can pay, he said with a kind of defiance. I've got money.
He struggled to pull out a handful of coins from his overall pocket. Coins rolled across the counter.
Put that away, I told him.
I told you, I can pay.
Stubborn now, igniting into rage.
I don't need...
I put my hand on his. I felt resistance for a moment, then his eyes met mine.
Nobody needs to do anything, I said gently.
I realized I had hurt his pride with my show of friendship.
I invited you.
The look of hostility remained unchanged.
I did the same with everyone else, I persisted. Caro Clermont, Guillaume Duplessis, even Paul-Marie Musca, the man who ran you out of the café.
A second's pause for him to register that.
What makes you so special that you can refuse where none of them did?
He looked ashamed then, mumbling something under his breath in his thick dialect. Then his eyes met mine again and he smiled.
Sorry, he said. I didn't understand.
He paused awkwardly for a few moments before picking up the pastry.
But next time, you're the ones invited to my place, he said firmly. And I shall be most offended if you refuse.
He was all right after that, losing much of his constraint. We talked of neutral topics for a while, but soon progressed to other things. I learned that Roux had been on the river for 6 years, alone at first, then travelling with a group of companions. He had been a builder once, and still earned money doing repair jobs and harvesting crops in summer and autumn. I gathered that there had been problems which forced him into the itinerant life, but knew better than to press for details. He left immediately as soon as the first of my regulars arrived. Guillaume greeted him politely, and Narcisse gave his brief nod of welcome. But I could not persuade Roux to stay to talk with them. Instead, he crammed what remained of his pain au chocolat into his mouth and walked out of the shop with that look of insolence and aloofness he feels he has to affect with strangers. As he reached the door, he turned abruptly.
"Don't forget your invitation," he told me,
as if on an afterthought.
"Saturday night, 7 o'clock. Bring the little stranger."
Then he was gone, before I could thank him. Guillaume lingered longer than usual over his chocolate. Narcisse gave his place to Georges, then Arnaud came over to buy 3 champagne truffles, always the same, 3 champagne truffles and a look of guilty anticipation. And Guillaume was still sitting in his usual place, a troubled look on his small-featured face. Several times I tried to draw him out, but he responded in polite monosyllables, his thoughts elsewhere. Beneath his seat, Charlie was limp and immobile. "I spoke to Cure Reno yesterday," he said at last, so abruptly that I gave a start. "I asked him what I ought to do about Charlie." I looked at him inquiringly. "It's hard to explain to him," continued Guillaume in his soft, precise voice. "He thinks I'm being stubborn, refusing to hear what the vet has to say. Worse still, he thinks I'm being foolish. It isn't as if Charlie were a person, after all." A pause, during which I could hear the effort he was making to retain his control. "Is it really that bad?" I already knew the answer. Guillaume looked at me with sad eyes. "I think so." "I see." Automatically he stooped to scratch Charlie's ear. The dog's tail thumped in a perfunctory way, and he whined softly. "There's a good dog." Guillaume gave me his small, bewildered smile. "Curé Reno isn't a bad man. He doesn't mean to sound cruel, but to say that in such a way..." "What did he say?" Guillaume shrugged. "He told me I'd been making a fool of myself over that dog for years now, that it was all the same to him what I did, but that it was ridiculous to coddle the animal as if it were a human being, or to waste my money on useless treatments for it." I felt a prick of anger. That was a spiteful thing to say. Guillaume shook his head. "He doesn't understand," he said again. "He doesn't really care for animals." "But Charlie and I have been together for so long." Tears stood in his eyes, and he moved his head sharply to hide them. "I'm on my way to the vet's now, just as soon as I've finished my drink." His glass had been standing empty on the counter for over 20 minutes. "It might not be today, might it?" There was a note almost of desperation in his voice. "He's still cheerful. He's been eating better recently. I know he has. And no one can make me do it." Now he sounded like a fractious child. "I'll know when the time really comes. I'll know." There was nothing I could say that would make him feel better. I tried, though. I bent to stroke Charlie, feeling the closeness of bone to skin beneath my moving fingers. Some things can be healed. I made my fingers warm, probing gently, trying to see. The burr already seemed larger. I knew it was hopeless. "He's your dog, Guillaume," I said. "You know best." "That's right." He seemed to brighten for a moment. "His medicine keeps the pain away. He doesn't whine any more in the night." I thought of my mother in those last months. Her pallor, the way the flesh melted from her, revealing a delicate beauty of stripped bone, bleached skin. Her bright and feverish eyes. "Florida, sweetheart, New York, Chicago, the Grand Canyon, so much to see." And her furtive cries in the night. "After a while, you just have to stop," I said. "It's pointless. Hiding behind justifications, setting short-term goals to see out the week. After a while, it's the lack of dignity that hurts more than anything else. You need to rest." Cremated in New York, ashes scattered across the harbor. Funny how you always imagine dying in bed, surrounded by your loved ones. Instead, too often, the brief, bewildering encounter, the sudden realization, the slow-motion panic ride with the sun coming up behind you like a swinging pendulum, however much you try to outrun it. "If I had a choice, I'd take this one. The painless needle, the friendly hand. Better that than alone in the night, or under the wheels of a cab in a street where no one stops to look twice." I realized that without meaning to, I had spoken aloud. "I'm sorry, Guillaume," I said, seeing his stricken look. "I was thinking about something else." "That's all right," he said quietly, putting the coins down onto the counter in front of him. "I was just going anyway." And picking up his hat with one hand and Charlie with the other, he went out, stooping a little more than usual, a small drab figure carrying what might have been a sack of groceries, or an old raincoat, or something else altogether.